Today's episode of Vital Voices is brought to you by Oak Tree Medical Center and King Group of Companies, including Cool Runnings Ice, Color Me Agency, and Retro Games 242.
Welcome to Vital Voices, the podcast where we bring medicine, mental health, and meaningful conversations to life. As we recognize May as Mental Health Awareness Month, today's episode is especially timely. We're diving into a powerful conversation about the early roots of mental health, specifically how adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, along with hereditary factors, can shape emotional and psychological well-being throughout life. Joining us are two experts in this field, Dr. Davina Knowles-Robinson and Dr. Tamika Johnson-Dames, both psychiatrists, who are here to help us navigate this conversation. Together, we'll unpack what ACEs really are, how trauma and family history intersect, and most importantly, what parents and caregivers can do to build resilience, seek support, and promote mental wellness from the start. If you care about mental health, especially for the next generation, this episode is for you. So let's begin. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So we, like I said, we had a brief conversation before we set up today's recording, talking about, you know, the roots of mental health issues, where it starts, and how a lot of this is rooted in either hereditary factors or what's called adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs. So let's start by breaking down that term for our listeners. So Dr. Knowles-Robinson, you know, what are ACEs? What are they? Why are they critical in understanding mental health?
So the argument of nature versus nurture is always very important. So when we look at ACEs, it's good to understand how your environment can mold or shape you. So ACEs, or if we look at childhood specifically, that's from 0 to 17 years old. So that's the demographic we're going to be looking at. So in childhood, and we like to think at times that children don't experience things, but they do. They experience any traumatic events just as adults may. And that could include violence, abuse, or neglect. So it's very critical to understand the importance of mental health in these childhood adversities and understand how it could link to risky health behaviors, chronic health conditions, low potential in life, and even early death, as we're seeing in our community, where a lot of younger men are dying secondary to violence. So to identify and mitigate these risks, it's very important to have these conversations and understand what we're looking at.
Okay. So what are some of the experiences that people can have?
So as a psychiatrist, we use the biopsychosocial model. And so this can happen in terms of your physical health, having a biological setback, or even emotional abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, having neglect, being neglected by a parent, making sure that you're taking care of the home, and that is ideally the parent's role, but now you're fending for yourself and having to figure out your own food, your how you're getting to school, how you maintaining your lunch, etc. Witnessing domestic violence. So we think that it's just about you, one, experiencing it for yourself, but even witnessing someone else being abused can cause this traumatic effect as well. Families that are using substances, etc.
Okay. Is like divorce, childhood, like parental death, things like that also
part
of it?
Yes, definitely. Having loss. So having lost a parent early in childhood, I can attest to that, losing my mother very early. And I think not navigating that space as quickly as it should be can develop into some adult traumas or issues. Also experiencing separation or divorce can lead parents or people, children, into feeling these ACEs as well.
So, Dr. Johnson-Dames, can you talk briefly about why childhood specifically is such a sensitive period for the long-term impact of these experiences? Because obviously, you know, you have people who are older, you know, young, like early 20s, mid-20s, who may experience some of these same sorts of things, even whether it's divorce, whether it's death of family members, abuse, things like that. But why is it such an important thing when you look at the childhood aspect of it and how that affects long-term?
Right. So childhood is that critical developmental period. So that is the period where there are brain structures, neuronal systems that are developed, that are fine-tuned, where your hormonal systems are formed. So during this period, if there are things that are happening that interfere with that, traumatic experience especially, that can disrupt these processes, that can lead to alterations in your stress response. You know that whenever something bad happens, we talk about the fight or flight response. Mm-hmm. So if you have something that happens in childhood that makes you think, I always on fight mood, then when you become an adult, there will always be this tendency to want to just go, as opposed to slow down and stop and think.
Right.
So some people react differently because I've been trained. My development, the things that have happened in my childhood have forced me to become this person. When you talk about emotional regulation issues, someone that grew up in a home where I didn't experience love, no one said that they loved me, no one gave me a hug. So as an adult, and I'm entering relationships now, and this woman or this man is looking at me to be nurturing and to be loving, I don't know how to do that because that was not how I was raised. You look at increased vulnerability to psychological disorders now because now it's difficult for me to process the world, to see the world the way that everybody else did because of things that happened that stopped me, that stunted that part of my growth and development.
You know, as I was having a conversation with another guest recently, they were talking about the importance of trauma-informed counseling, because now you have to consider, like, if this is someone who's coming from an experience where they've had, whether it's physical trauma, emotional trauma, things like that, that then influences how even you as a professional interact with them, because you have to take into consideration that component of it and how, I guess, different things that you may do in your practice, maybe triggers or things like that. Fight or flight is a very serious thing,
they
because if you're stuck in that space where you automatically have that reaction, you're not going to react like someone who has, from my understanding, normal brain chemistry. Because now you're reacting in a very different way, and that all kind of then plays out differently how you have just everyday life interactions. So let's go into that a little bit deeper. You know, how exactly do these experiences, these ACEs, affect brain development and mental health over the long term?
That is definitely a very good segue, because ACEs can lead to brain structure and function changes. So not to get too technical, but just to understand it a little bit more, you can have reduction of the prefrontal cortex, which influences things like emotions and regulation of mood and the changes in the amygdala. So when we're looking at that, the stress response, the emotional response that someone that isn't living in fight and flight their whole life, they're now responding to that all the time. So their changes in their brain is happening. These lead to heightened emotional sensitivity. They don't know how to conflict resolute. And so being in this situation all the time, I use the example of a dripping water on the foundation is not going to do much. But if we have that same drip, and that they say that this is Chinese torture at some point, where the dripping water on the forehead is not going to cause any damage for a minute. Let that same drip of water happen for a month, a year, is going to bore a hole. It's going to cause some damage. It's going to cause some psychological effects as well. So in the same way, if you're having this violence or witnessing this experience for a long period of time from 0 to 17, you're going to have these changes in the brain as well.
It's interesting because it helps to explain, like, I mean, from everything that we see on our news and even just in our daily lives as we interact with others, we generally speaking as a population have a lot of struggles with conflict resolution. But then we also have a lot of cases of abuse, you know, mental, emotional, physical, sexual, and violence, and all of these things. So it kind of makes sense then, if you look at the how much of that we have, why that then, because you're saying people who have these experiences sometimes have difficulty navigating conflict resolution, and now it kind of, you see why we have some of the challenges that we have, because adults, whether it's friend to friend, whether it's in romantic relationships, even with Like, we've seen stories of people killing family members, brothers, mothers, sisters, fathers, all of those sorts of things. It kind of shows that perhaps we have a very strong underlying mental health concern as a country, as a nation, absolutely. As a people.
And so it gets you back to that learned helplessness or learned behavior, mm-hmm. too. Like, if that is all that I see every day, mm-hmm. then how do I know any different? Like, if I've learned that to resolve a conflict, I must hit, I must shout, I right. must bite, whatever it is that I'm in that space all the time seeing, mm-hmm. it's going to echo into my new relationship and my new partner. Like, that is how I resolve conflict, because I've seen that all the time. Mm-hmm. You have some people that take these experiences and say, well, I don't want to be like that,
right.
but it's less likely because I rather echo what I've seen. Mm-hmm. As opposed to change.
Because I feel like we have a natural drawing to what we've seen. It's like, it's what you know.
Right.
So even if you don't like it, a lot of times without, I imagine, intervention, that still becomes almost like you're, it's like home base. It's like you're drawn right. to it almost by default.
Right.
So Dr. Johnson Dames, what role does genetics or hereditary factors play in determining who even might be more susceptible to mental health disorders?
And I absolutely love this question, because it's a question that we get all the time when we look at mental illnesses. And this is speaking to adults now, mm-hmm. after you've already had your childhood experiences,
right.
and now all of a sudden you become mentally unwell. Mm-hmm. And persons will say, you know, the first thing the Bahamians like to say, will he get lace, maybe? Because it feels easier to say, let me put this on something external, mm-hmm. not on something internal or otherwise environmental. So genetics definitely can predispose you to certain mental health disorders, because of course that also deals with the influences that those genetics will play on your brain chemistry, mm-hmm. and also affects your ability to manage and cope with stress. So someone that has a predisposition to a particular mental illness, let's say anxiety or depression, then you put them in a backdrop of adverse childhood experiences, whether it was abuse, whether it was neglect, whether it was some type of trauma, right? And now they go off to college. College should be a happy time. It's a beautiful, fun experience. And then you realize, I'm by myself. Mm-hmm. I have to manage my own affairs. I have to figure out how I'm going to eat. I have to study, go to class, clean my room. That's stressful. And now all of a sudden, I go to a party. I may decide to experiment with some drugs. Everyone else is fine, mm-hmm. but I'm the only one that gets sick. Mm-hmm. So then the question is, oh, they must have put something in your drugs
right.
that made you sick, mm-hmm. and everybody else fine. But no, let's look back at your brain chemistry, mm-hmm. because you probably would have, without the drugs, developed mm-hmm. that illness at a certain point in time, but the drug now helps. That is now the environmental factor that helped to lead to the expression of that particular illness. Mm-hmm. So genetic predispositions most certainly can trigger illnesses that were already going to be developed in a particular person.
What about in the reverse? Like, what if you already have a genetic predisposition? Can these adverse childhood experiences activate predispositions that already exist? And if so, how does that happen?
Absolutely. So it's a similar concept. So the activation, there's something that's called gene-environment interaction.
Okay.
So when the genes that are right within you now are triggered by what's happening in the environment, even when we talk about things at the hormonal level, mm-hmm. stress activates certain hormones in the body. I'm sure that, you know, a lot of people have heard about the stress hormone, which is cortisol. Mm-hmm. Cortisol can be responsible for the development of physical conditions like high blood pressure, in addition to mental health conditions like anxiety. So stress from adverse childhood experiences can trigger changes in how your genes are expressed. So it can emphasize or mitigate predisposed vulnerabilities towards developing certain mental health disorders.
You know, I wonder too then, so if I'm someone who went through adverse childhood experiences, let's say I don't ever really develop anything particular, but does that then, like if I have kids, does that then make it possible that that becomes a genetic predisposition for my kids? Like, how does that work?
So that is an interesting topic as well, because I did a presentation on the effects of childhood trauma before. Mm-hmm. And there's one theory that says that sometimes your children suffer from trauma that they did not even experience.
Wow.
Why does that happen? Because now I am showing my children how to live based off of my traumatic experiences.
Right.
So if I was a person that went through something, and we spoke about that fight or flight response, mm-hmm. and I'm saying now I only know how to fight, I'm not gonna teach my children nothing else, because
right.
this is how you live and this is how you survive. So you guys have seen the meme before where people say there are some people that are based, that are raised off of love, and some people are raised off of survival.
Mm-hmm.
So the persons that are raised off of survival may not necessarily be because I went through something. It could be because my parents went through something and that is what they taught me. So definitely affects.
And to touch on that point as well, so the studies are called epigenetics, where
mm-hmm.
you have your genes and you have nature and how they influence things. And so recently, within the last week, I saw this story about this guy who got a heart transplant
mm-hmm.
from another male who ended up killing himself,
mm-hmm.
right? So 7 years later, or whatever the timeline, he ends up falling in love with, which is kind of weird and wonderful too in this story, with the previous heart donor's wife.
Mm-hmm.
They end up getting married. I think they get married for X amount of years.
Mm-hmm.
He ends up killing himself. So the comments under were like, well, the common denominator was the wife. However, there are studies now that show where donors experience the same complications in terms of lifestyle modifications
mm-hmm.
of their previous owners,
mm-hmm.
meaning that there is some, so if we're not even looking at children, we're looking at the links of genes and,
right.
and organs and how
mm-hmm.
they have memory, right?
Mm-hmm.
So these organs, and I don't want to sound eerie or sci-fi-ish,
no.
but have memory of their past experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So even though this person, so like I've seen things too where people talk about, oh, I never liked, for example, Doritos.
Mm-hmm.
And now all of a sudden, because they've gotten this donor's liver,
mm-hmm.
they like Doritos. But they hated it before.
Gotcha.
Because the memory is like, this is nostalgic for me.
Right.
So in that same way, if we're talking about mental health, in terms of the suicide, the heart remembers. And so we talk about brain connections, but the heart is almost the same as the mind, right?
Yeah, that's crazy.
Okay. Where it's like, I remembered feeling depressed. I remember being heartbroken
mm-hmm.
or sad or mm-hmm. these other tie-ins. And it's just like, if that is true for just organs, the genes that we pass on to our kids are basically the same.
Mm-hmm.
Where it now predisposes us to things like post-traumatic stress disorders,
right.
depression, mood
mm-hmm.
illnesses, anxiety, substance abuse, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So we've always separated nature versus nurture, but epigenetics puts it together where
mm-hmm.
it's like, these genes matter.
And yeah, because these things interact.
Nature and nurture both interact
mm-hmm.
and make us who we are.
Yeah. It's a little morbid, but I was like, I hope they didn't donate the heart to anybody else.
Right, right.
I
thought
that too.
Yeah, I didn't read further, but it was
but
very interesting.
It also, because it sounds like, so like, I'll use my wife as an example. When she was pregnant with our second kid, so like tilapia was something always that we always ate, right?
Mm-hmm.
When she got pregnant with Asher, she could not. So now Asher's two. Asher does not eat tilapia. He will eat salmon. He will eat like snapper. He will eat other fish. He will not eat tilapia. She still can't eat tilapia.
Right.
And so it's like, it's almost similar to how people may have that experience when they go through pregnancy where there's something that the baby don't like. And now all of a sudden something that you used to eat and it was fine. Now you still can't eat it even for her like 2 years later.
Right.
So it's different, but it's similar in that sort of way of how things can change and how all of these things play together.
Right.
Yeah, but let's.
I hope you're enjoying this episode of Vital Voices.
We'll
be right back.
Discover the ultimate in personalized healthcare with the Oak Tree Primary Plus program. Enjoy comprehensive primary care, annual physicals, lab and imaging discounts, mental health screenings, and more, all tailored to meet your needs. With flexible payment options, exceptional care has never been more accessible. Join today and take control of your health journey. Call 242-8164-OPP, 4667, or visit oaktreemedicalcenter.com. Oak Tree Primary Plus, where your health comes first.
Gentlemen, it's time to take charge of your health with Oak Tree Medical Center. We provide comprehensive prostate care at affordable prices, from prostate-specific antigen tests to prostate ultrasounds to advanced prostate MRIs. We've got you covered. Need further evaluation or treatment? Oak Tree Surgical Suites offers biopsies and in-house surgery. Our team of experts is here for you every step of the way. Visit us at Oak Tree Medical Center on East Street South and Prince Charles Drive, or for surgical procedures, find us at Oak Tree Surgical Suites, top of the hill, Mackey Street. Call us today at 322-1145 or visit oaktreemedicalcenter.com. Oak Tree Medical Center. Caring, compassionate, complete.
Ladies, at Oak Tree Medical Center, your health is our priority. From early detection to advanced treatment options, our comprehensive breast care services are here to support you every step of the way. With locations at East Street South, Prince Charles Drive, and our state-of-the-art surgical suites and MRI at Top of the Hill, Mackey Street, we're right where you need us. Because when it comes to your breast care, you deserve the best care. And remember, the Million Mammogram movement continues. Call us today at 242-321-145 or visit oaktreemedicalcenter.com to learn more. Oak Tree Medical Center. Caring. Compassionate. Complete.
Welcome back to Vital Voices. Let's continue our conversation.
Okay, so are there certain mental health disorders, getting back on topic, that are more commonly associated with ACEs, hereditary factors, or both?
Yeah, so like I was saying, in terms of the epigenetics, mm-hmm. post-traumatic stress disorders, PTSD, depression, anxiety, substance abuse disorders, they're all connected to these ACEs as well. Mm-hmm. So when we look at hereditary factors, thank you, that are involved, these conditions may manifest a little bit more than in other people.
Right.
Yeah.
So let's take a step forward and let's talk about, you know, recognizing signs and early intervention. And I think I have a question that's going to come at the end of this segment that isn't on our list, but it's important as I think through it. But let's start with what we have. So what signs should parents or caregivers look for that might indicate that their child is struggling mentally due to either ACEs or genetic factors?
So as a parent, it's very important to watch and listen to your child. Communication, mm-hmm. understanding who they are first, mm-hmm. Watching them, not necessarily for signs, but having that open conversation as to who they are as individuals. Mm-hmm. So when you now know who your child is. And so like even in med school, we learned you need to know what normal is before you can assess for abnormal. So if you know who your child is, you can recognize things like behavioral changes. Mm-hmm. So you're watching for things like withdrawal and irritability, changes in sleep patterns, academic decline. So if your child was once a 3.5 student, a 2.9 student, and now all of a sudden, out of the blue, they're now a 1-point student. Mm-hmm. Not like that slight decline where it's like maybe the class is a little bit harder, but like a you have this dramatic decline in, mm-hmm. in academic performance, then maybe there's something going on with this child. Unexplained physical symptoms. All of a sudden, your child was well, now they're always vomiting, mm-hmm. nauseous. They're always having headaches. Mm-hmm. What's changed in the environment? What has changed maybe at school, having a conversation to learn, is there something different and do I need to now address that?
Right. Okay. At which stage should a parent seek professional support for their child and how do you even begin that process? Because I imagine it's very delicate.
Mm-hmm. So I would say as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people like to play the watch and wait game, which can be very risky. Mm-hmm. When we look at the diagnosis of certain mental health conditions. So timelines are very important for us. Okay. A condition like depression, you only need 2 weeks of symptoms. So a lot of times when persons present and they're like, oh yeah, this has been going on for 3 years. It's like, 3 years?
Wow.
3 years? Like you meet diagnostic criteria in 2 weeks, mm-hmm. for depression. Mm-hmm. When we look at anxiety symptoms, a month of symptoms, not that you need to wait that entire time, but from you start to see changes that interact or interfere with their ability to function, mm-hmm. that's oftentimes a telltale sign that it's time to seek help. Even if you're not significantly worried, if it is enough for you to recognize as Knowles Robinson said, paying attention to what is normal and then being able to identify what is abnormal. From you notice something abnormal, have the conversation. When it's time for you to take them to their pediatrician, if there's a family physician that you use, reach out to someone. You don't have to take it on your own. You don't have to be able to diagnose the problem, but bring it up, because symptoms that people take for granted, like insomnia, changes in appetite, you may not think anything of it, but your pediatrician, your mental health professional, your psychiatrist, your psychologist may say, well, you know what? That's a telltale sign of something else. Let me dig a little deeper. And they would know the right questions to ask to figure out what is happening with your child.
You know, we here at Vital Voices are strong proponents of preventative care, things like that. You know, we've had multiple conversations with primary care providers, and it speaks to the importance of having those regular visits, because it's how you develop and understand patterns of behavior. You know what the history is for a child. And so we will always take an opportunity to remind people that it's important to do that, because that sometimes you can miss it, right? It's like we can get so caught up in just the day-to-day of life that as parents, as family members, we can miss things. But if you have those regular visits happening, you have an opportunity for, whether it's your pediatrician or a family medicine physician, to say, hey, there's something here that's different, and kind of point it out and draw attention to it. And then you can kind of pursue it down that line from there.
Right. To that same point, like, we like to, as a community, just go to the doctor when we're not well. So it's good to identify the signs, but it's also good to do wellness checks. So why are you not taking your child to see the doctor often?
Because we don't think it's necessary.
Right. So we're only going to take the child to the doctor when they have the cough or the cold and the tummy aches, and when they're not sleeping, when they're not well, etc. We've identified the, and so that is important too. It has its place.
Right.
But to your original question, it's important to do wellness checks as well. So when is it important to see a psychiatrist or a talk therapist? Regularly, just as you would your pediatrician. I mean, for a child, you may not see the place for it, but that's a good way to build that rapport, to get that alignment, to understand that there might be changes that they might miss, and we could help navigate those spaces as well.
You know, so I'll add in this question here, because I think it's critical, because when we talk about ACEs, sometimes the parent or the caregiver may be a part of the actual traumatic experience, right? So how then, if you are a teacher, another member of the family, a loved one who has some involvement, maybe like a coach, if they play like a sport, things like that, how do you then try to assist if you're on the outside, so to speak, looking in, and the parent or the caregiver is actually a part of the problem, but you recognize some of these signs?
I love that question, because working in the public sector as well as the private sector, there has been such an influx of children coming in for things like self-harm. Right, which is not necessarily trying to end life, but they are doing things like cutting, burning, etc. And as a parent, they might say, oh, they're just looking for attention, right? Even if they're taking, you know, tablets like the multivitamins, and we're saying, oh, they're just looking for attention. That is, that could be a truth where they are looking for attention, they're seeking help. But as a teacher, the guidance counselor, because most schools do provide those services, recognizing the signs is very important, because more times than not, the child is in the environment of school 70% of the time. So these are the spaces that should be identifying the problems. So if you see that it is 90 degrees outside and a child is wearing a jacket, why? Ask the child to remove the jacket. Can I see your arms? Like, so I'm not to be invasive, but that is a clear-cut sign that this child is doing something like cutting their arms because they don't want people to see. I know growing up, wearing a jacket in school in 11th or 12th grade might have meant that you were pregnant. And that is another telltale sign.
Right.
Like, because why is it hot? But that is something just as a simple thing as that.
Right.
Why is this child wearing a jacket? If the child... I know as teachers, kudos to my teachers. I know this is Teacher Appreciation Month as well as Nurses Appreciation. They are dealing with a lot in our community. So I don't want to negate your role, but to get on a child for sleeping in class or being disheveled or not understanding that that child is probably going through hell and high water at home. So identifying, why did you come to school with a dirty shirt?
Right.
Maybe I don't have running water. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's not that I wanted to come to school looking like this. Right. Maybe I didn't want to come to school
maybe
malodorous.
Maybe my parents don't didn't have... sleep home.
Right.
And I have to get myself sleep in the car. Ready. I have to get my siblings ready. I have to make sure they have something to eat. I have to walk them to school. I have to take them on the bus. And then I get myself to school at the end of the day. I'm an adult here. Okay. Right. I have just
seven.
That's the thing. So what's the crazy thing for me is even I think when you were talking in one of our earlier questions, you know, this, it sounded very much like what we would know for our generation as latchkey kids, right? And it's like, okay, so I walked home from school. I started walking home from school off and on when I was in like 8th or 9th grade, right? Mm-hmm. But I will drive on the streets, me and my wife, all the time, and we see 6-7 year olds walking home. Sometimes you see what looks like a 9-year-old girl and her like 7-6-5 year old mm-hmm. brother, right. And they're walking home from school and they're by themselves. Like we were driving up East Street the other day and this girl looked like she couldn't be any older than 8 and she was walking home on East Street by herself. And I'm like,
and it's grinding your gears, right?
Yeah, because I'm like,
but why is this happening?
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it's like you said, you don't know necessarily what these kids are going through, what the experiences are at home. And so it is very much a delicate thing to try and navigate because there's a level of want. And then we so like to keep people out of our business, right? And so I imagine for teachers, it's a very, very tough line to walk when you have concern and you want to look into it. But then you're also in a school system that may be telling you, hey, don't worry about that. Don't bother with that. Your job is to get them to the end of the school year, right? Which some of the schools may have that approach. And so you have all of these different things that come into play, but then in the middle of it all, you have this innocent child who really probably just needs help. Yeah. And it's like, how do you find ways to help in that regard? You know, I think one of probably the biggest questions in this conversation is, you know, you both have experience in this space of talking, I imagine, with kids and families, loved ones, etc. What are some common mistakes that families or caregivers make when they are addressing these concerns, especially in our environment, which isn't always the safest for things like mental health?
So I will start with the fact that the Bahamas is a Christian nation. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest things that we typically hear is you need to go to God in prayer.
Right.
This is happening because you're not praying enough. You're not spending enough time in the Word. This is demonic. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it is turned into something that is solely spiritual, mm-hmm. and not separating the two completely,
right.
but understanding that someone can still be a Christian and still struggle with mental health issues.
Yes.
Another thing that parents do is minimize the experience. Mm-hmm. So while, what do you mean she's depressed? Like I've talked about depression and anxiety with mm-hmm. teens and their parents, and it's like, yeah, but this girl don't have nothing to worry about. I pay all the bills. She have the finest clothes and finest shoes. And it's like, but if you recognize what's happening on the inside, it has nothing to do with all of the provisions that you're making that you think should cover
right. The
multitude of things that she's experiencing. Right. How many celebrities do we know that have committed suicide? And these are people that are millionaires.
That's the thing. Sometimes it's exactly what you aren't saying that isn't being covered that is the problem. So they may have all of the bills paid, the nicest clothes, but they may not have a connection with you as their parent.
Right.
They may not feel safe being able to talk to you. They may not feel like you're someone that they can trust, or you've hurt them in some other way. And you have to be able to recognize that component of it. But you're right. I think you can navigate both of those worlds together mm-hmm. in terms of where faith and spirituality intersect with mental health, and it doesn't have to be separate.
Right.
It's those two things can work hand in hand to bring about a healthier result for the person that may be going through this sort of traumatic experience or through this mental health concern.
And then another thing that can happen is, even for those persons that recognize, okay, yes, we are Christians, but yes, I recognize that this is something greater than just spiritual. This mm-hmm. is someone that needs professional help. It is the stigma that surrounds seeking help. So some persons may say, well, you know what, let's just wait and see if it'll change. We don't want to go to a psychiatrist because I don't want people to call my child crazy. I've seen persons in the emergency room. When I say, unwell, unwell, but had family members say, I don't want them in Sandilands. You are clearly here in the emergency room because this is far more, far greater than you are able to manage. So the reason why you are here is to get help. So if you weren't able to help them at home, and I'm telling you that we have a place where they can get help, but you are saying to me, well, I don't want them to get help, but not there.
Right.
So we have our own biases that we have that stops people from seeking help and also from accepting the help when it's offered. Because there are some persons that are unwell, like with psychotic illnesses, and you may tell them, the way to treat psychosis is an antipsychotic. I can't talk you out of a psychotic state. I have to give you medications. Right. And they would say, is there another way? What if I drink seaweed? No, you can't drink seaweed for the psychosis. You need an antipsychotic medication. That there's no way around it. So sometimes people seek help, but they don't want the help that you have to offer.
So that is interesting to consider all of those sorts of elements, because like you said, there are certain things where talk therapy isn't the answer. There is the need for a medication as intervention. And we have to be willing to understand it. I think, you know, we continue to have these conversations on shows like this and in other spaces because we want to educate people and get them comfortable with the idea. You know, I've heard people tell me, you know, you'd be surprised as to people who are on their job working every day, but they have to go and get treatment for mental health issues from time to time. They have to, you know, go to Sandilands to see their psychiatrist or whatever it is, but they're still out here living a normal life. And I think stories like those need to be told, right? And so we have to be able to have conversations like these and help to break the stigma around it, because there are people who can actually be helped to get over these issues, and they're being left almost to their own devices because of these sorts of issues, whether it's stigma, whether it's, oh, let's just pray our way through it, and that's the only thing that we can do, all of those sorts of different components, when a lot of times it's a multifaceted approach that's required to help people navigate this stuff.
Yeah, I like to quote James all the time, faith without works is dead. So yes, you have the faith, yes, you believe, and yes, I want you to believe in your healing, and that's even for physical ailments as it is with mental ailments. But the works is taking the medication, seeing your psychiatrist, doing the things that you need to do to stay well. To your point, there are people that are out here functioning, killing it in life because they are getting the help that they need. They're doing the work for their mental health.
Correct.
So at the end of the day, both things can work in tandem. You can be well, you can have a mental illness, and you can still function.
Yep. Yeah. Pray and pop pills.
Yep.
So as we move on, what can families realistically do at home to help children recover from or build resilience against adverse experiences? Because obviously, you know, we've talked through signs and symptoms, we've talked through kind of, you know, the early warning signs, things like that, what these experiences are. But now let's look at what support looks like. What can families do?
Like we said earlier in the pod, the biopsychosocial model. So yes, the biologics are the medications, they have a role. The psychological might be the talk therapy. And the social is the family. At the end of the day, it is these environments that these children are going to be predominantly in.
Right.
So in an ideal situation, we've spoken about this as well, communication, learning your child, learning each other, and making sure that this environment is safe enough to have these healthy conversations.
Right.
And that circles us back to a safe space. These places need to be, the home environment should feel like a comfy, cozy space where I am able to feel at peace. The rest of the world is burning down, but at home, I can take off my over armor and have this, I can unpeel my onion. I can make sure that this is the realest I can be here at home with my parents. And I understand that everything that is shared here, I can either get some resolution or some guidance or some place where I can go and know that I am safe. regular family activities. When was the last time you and your kids played Monopoly together? Right. When was the last time you engaged, not just Netflix and chilling, that has its own role, but are you really talking when you Netflix and chilling, right? No, but having family activities that garner the openness and the safety of communication as well, which will build resilience and teach the proper coping skills that these kids need. Mm-hmm. I know that this is, like I said, an ideal situation. And you brought up the point before, what if the parent is the reason why this child is here? And that's where alliances come in, where you have the close family friend, the teacher, the guidance counselor that recognizes the signs. And a lot of the times, for me as a clinician, when the person comes in, I have it where the parent or the guardian is in the space with the child, but you also have that moment where the child is free and alone, where you're saying, hi, thank you for bringing the child in. Thank you for seeing the importance of mental health. But I'm going to have to ask you to leave this space so I can talk to this child. So family is not just your mother, your father, your brother, your sister. Family can also be auntie, friend, person that recognizes this child is not safe.
Yeah.
And making that right, making that safe space and transition to get into these spaces as well.
Yeah. You know, are there specific parenting strategies, tools, or even resources that you would recommend to families that are dealing with, whether it's hereditary vulnerabilities or adverse childhood experiences?
So for starters, there are times that young people do feel as though I can't tell my mommy, I can't tell my daddy because they're not going to listen to me. Mm-hmm. All they can do is row and say, oh, well, in my day, we did this and we did that. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, you're too young to do this or feel this way. And so sometimes instead of being open and honest, they go and talk to their friends and their friends don't know no better.
Nope.
So sometimes being able to listen, even though as a parent, some things that your children, especially your teens, may tell you, you're going to cringe because you're going to be like, you did what? You want to do what? But sometimes it's good to show them that I can listen without arguing.
Right.
And I can tell you how I feel about something without making you feel like you are so bad and you are so awful. Because our parents were worse than us. They just didn't have social media back then to record every little thing that they did. Wow. You hear the music? I could call a few Bohemian songs right now and I'm like, y'all was on to something else back then. So listening and having that open air is one thing. Mm-hmm. And next thing is being consistent with your no's and your yeses. Mm. So sometimes I find in parenting, when you see children going through things, of course, kids are going to want to test boundaries. Mm-hmm. So when you tell them, no, you can't do a particular thing, you can't turn around next week and say, okay, you could do it then, because they're always going to test you. Mm-hmm. So you have to be consistent as a parent. So in listening to them, in lending an open air, in not judging, also in being a firm parent. So there's a difference between being friends and best friends with your children or being a parent that I could be cool, I could listen without arguing, but I'm still in charge and I still run my house.
Yeah.
And then there's also, as Knowles and I mentioned already in the podcast, making sure that you are aware of changes that happen in your children and making sure that you take them to seek help.
Yeah.
Making sure that support systems are available. So if you know that you're probably not the nicest or the easiest person to talk to, tell your child, well, go to Annie Davina, because you know your mommy, I can't have them kind of things. I don't want to have nothing but no drugs. I don't want to have nothing but no boys. Go to your Annie, talk to your Annie with that. So making sure that your parents know that this is my limitation. This is my boundary. This is something that I probably am not comfortable about talking to my kids with, but I am directing them to someone that I know and trust that may be able to help them, whether it's a pastor, a youth leader, someone else in the community.
Yeah, that trust part is important.
So
how can communities, schools, extended family provide support for children and families who may be going through these issues?
So communities, specifically the schools, can provide very good health programs specific or geared towards mental health. And I say that to say in any talk that I do, I speak about social emotional regulation programs in schools, mm-hmm. where there are classes, just as you have your math, your English, teaching emotional regulation, teaching what that looks like in schools is important, because we've already established 70% of their time is in the school environment. Yep. There are schools now teaching it, so it can be done. So implementing these programs in schools so they understand that this is important. How do I do conflict resolutions? How do I understand my emotions? How do I identify that I'm having a mental health issue? Mm-hmm. So bringing in clinicians, psychiatrists, psychologists, etc., into the school environments so that they, the students that is, can regulate and understand their emotions. Mm-hmm. Doing training programs in the schools where the teachers can identify this is a problem, mm-hmm. so that they are fully versed in identifying and addressing these issues appropriately. Right. Doing things like this, the podcast, where you're giving educational information, but it's a place where people can listen, learn, and understand. Mm-hmm. And to Dr. James's point, listening to understand, not listening to judge. So you're not listening to rebut either. So you're listening to understand, well, this is how you feel, and I don't have an answer for it. Mm-hmm. So not everything that they're coming to you for, you need to say, well, like she said, back in my day, I did this. This isn't about you. Mm-hmm. And this isn't about your time. This is about me and what I'm going through. So it's listening to understand, not to judge, not to rebut, but having that place where you're understanding what this person, this child is going through.
Mm-hmm. So shameless plug, in a moment of transparency, I raise a teen and a toddler. So yesterday we were in the car heading home from
that's tough life.
Right? And so I was talking to my daughter and we were talking, I don't know how we got in the conversation about physical appearance and how you look going mm-hmm. certain places. And I said, you know what? I remember when I was your age, like you couldn't get me to go certain places if I looked a certain way or if I felt like my hair wasn't fixed mm-hmm. or my outfit wasn't together. And I said, now I'm at the age where if I run out to the store to get something, I really don't care. I'm not going to have a headband on my head or something or a bonnet on my head. But I'm not that concerned because what I have to offer the world is so much more. Like, I got 4 degrees. Like, you really think I'm about to worry about y'all looking at if my slippers ain't cute slippers, you know? And I said, but at your age, like, I understand how you feel. Like, that's all you got. You don't even have a high school diploma yet. So all you have right now is your self-esteem and you're building confidence. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is steeped in my physical appearance. Right. Does it make sense to us now at 35? No. But to a 16-year-old, absolutely. I care about how I look and if my friend's going to see me. So sometimes it's tapping into who you were as a child and trying to relate to them on that level.
But to that same point that you were making, my dad used to say something to us all the time that now slaps. Because I now see myself and saying those type of things as well. When I'm going to the grocery store, he would say, he would be wearing mismatched shoes, high socks, a t-shirt. And I'm just like, this is not
it. Why you look like a Jones?
He said, who is rushing to the counter to pay my bill? No one. So I'm going to dress how I feel and what I need to do. And, I find myself now as an adult, I don't care. I do not care because, no one's racing to the counter to pay my bill.
Yeah.
And it's the thought that when it's time to dress up, I'm going to step.
Right.
So, I mean, I'm not concerned about if someone sees me. Yeah, it's time and place. I run in the store, I'm not concerned. But as a child,
you understand.
I wouldn't put my kids through the feeling of, my mommy said I shouldn't care, so now I embarrass and I shame. Let them be kids.
No, and similarly, you wouldn't drop out of school looking any type of way either, right?
Correct.
So you understand the difference between, that's an age and stage thing, right?
Correct.
But listen, very much right. You get to a certain point with certain things. It's just if you're going into a business meeting, you're going in to see a patient, that's one thing. Right. But you run into the store to grab milk because you need to have milk before the store closes. You're not necessarily considering, I have to look the cutest in this moment.
I hope you're enjoying this episode of Vital Voices. We're going to take a quick break for some words from our sponsors, and we'll be right back.
Discover the ultimate in personalized health care with the Oak Tree Primary Plus program. Enjoy comprehensive primary care, annual physicals, lab and imaging discounts, mental health screenings, and more, all tailored to meet your needs. With flexible payment options, exceptional care has never been more accessible. Join today and take control of your health journey. Call 242-8164-OPP, 4667, or visit oaktreemedicalcenter.com. Oak Tree Primary Plus, where your health comes first.
Gentlemen, it's time to take charge of your health with Oak Tree Medical Center. We provide comprehensive prostate care at affordable prices, from prostate-specific antigen tests to prostate ultrasounds to advanced prostate MRIs. We've got you covered. Need further evaluation or treatment? Oak Tree Surgical Suites offers biopsies and in-house surgery. Our team of experts is here for you every step of the way. Visit us at Oak Tree Medical Center on East Street South and Prince Charles Drive, or for surgical procedures, find us at Oak Tree Surgical Suites, top of the hill, Mackey Street. Call us today at 322-1145 or visit oaktreemedicalcenter.com. Oak Tree Medical Center. Caring, compassionate, complete.
Ladies, at Oak Tree Medical Center, your health is our priority. From early detection to advanced treatment options, our comprehensive breast care services are here to support you every step of the way. With locations at East Street South, Prince Charles Drive, and our state-of-the-art surgical suites and MRI at Top of the Hill, Mackey Street, we're right where you need us. Because when it comes to your breast care, you deserve the best care. And remember, the Million Mammogram Movement continues. Call us today at 242-32-21145 or visit oaktreemedicalcenter.com to learn more. Oak Tree Medical Center. Caring. Compassionate. Complete.
Welcome back to Vital Voices. Let's continue our conversation.
All right. For families that may be feeling overwhelmed or unsure where to start, what single piece of advice would each of you give to them?
So there's one thing to spend the time, the energy, and the effort going to talk to a professional. But when they give you their professional opinion, don't backtrack and say, but that's not what I want. If it is that the problem was significant enough that you thought that you needed assistance, then take the assistance that's being offered and run with it.
Oh my God, I think you are in the space when I'm seeing some of my clients, because I know several stories, and I'm not trying to say that I'm God, by any means not, because I tell that to my patients all the time too. I'm not afraid of you seeking a second opinion. Mm-hmm. I'm not afraid, like when you come into this space, I do have a listen and not judge approach. Mm-hmm. I do have that, I'm listening to understand. I understand that, you know, you meet the client where they're at, because, you know, insight is important, and understanding, you know, where you are in terms of your own mental space is important, mm-hmm. and even your financial obligation. So I'm not going to prescribe a $1,000 drug when a $50 or a $10 drug might perform just the same. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to shove a medication down your throat either, mm-hmm. when I know you might not be interested in taking a medication. So I have the conversation, I give asterisks and, mm-hmm. and things all of the time where I'm saying, well, you might not want it now, but if this, and this may happen, then we might have to strong arm you a little bit more or have a deeper conversation. But you're right, we don't need to go this avenue right now. Mm-hmm. So I say all of that to say that you come to me, I'm not saying or dictating what you need to, or should or have to do. Mm-hmm. I'm giving guidelines and recommendations, right? What irks me, because this has happened with several parents and kids that have come in both private and public spaces, mm-hmm. you're asking for advice, you're asking for recommendations. I'm telling you this. If I'm giving you 10 things, I'm not expecting you to do all 10, maybe not even all 5, but at least we can implement one or two.
Right.
You're coming back to me a month later with the same problem. Like, and I say, I am not Jesus. You cannot touch the hem of my garment, and that's it.
Right.
So coming into the space for 30 minutes, an hour, where we're having the conversation, right? We're having the conversation and you're miraculously healed. That's not what's going to happen.
Right.
Like we said, the faith and the works thing, they go in tandem. So mm-hmm. you cannot just come to me in faith that just this talk alone is going to, no, you're going to put in the work. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to be able to implement these suggestions, mm-hmm. recommendations, I gave you 10, can we choose at least two of them? Yeah. Because otherwise, you're wasting your time, your money, and my energy, because mm-hmm. I'm not going to keep repeating the same thing over and over.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's a part of that is coming into it with an open mind, because you're not just doing it to go through the motions. If you're going to come in and see someone, be willing to at least take some of the advice and implement something, like you're right. saying. Because I imagine sometimes you give 10 options because your hope is, okay, they're going to at least do one, and then there's some help or some change that may come about. Right.
And then we could, like I said, I like to build a foundation. So at the end of the day, if we at least try one thing, then we're going to stack something else correct. On top of that yeah. and learn. But if we have literally have nothing mm-hmm. that we're working on besides you coming to the office.
And you never know. You might strike gold with that first thing. Correct. You try something and that might be enough.
Right.
I think it's also important, like you said, you know, I know both of you kind of spoken from the standpoint of your interest as a psychiatrist is to ensure that people get help, even if it's not necessarily with you.
Right.
And to that end, I know there are, because of the stigmas that exist, I know there are online platforms that exist. There are virtual appointments that exist for people to be able to kind of have conversations in a way that's a lot more, you know, private and quiet.
Yeah, I don't like that word private, because if you come to us, it's very confidential. Quite but.
Well, private in that you don't have to be seen walking in right. to see mm-hmm. someone. Because right. I think that's the sometimes what it is. If you know you're walking into an office and the only thing, see, that's the other thing. You work in a space where at least at in the Oak Tree space, someone walks into this office, they don't know which doctor that person right. is coming to see.
Right.
But if you're running a psychiatry only firm mm-hmm. and someone comes in, someone driving past and they see you walking into your office on Shirley Street as an example, right? Correct. Then it's like, oh, they're gonna go see something wrong, right?
Right.
So from that standpoint, when I say private, yeah. that's what it means. As in no one has to see you physically or be able to see you physically engaging in the space.
That's what telehealth is for, too.
Right. And so that's why I said you have telehealth, you have online platforms like BetterHelp, things like that exist.
Yes, correct.
So even if you're not comfortable because you feel like our Bahamian space is so small, then there are these things that exist and there are ways to go and find help.
So, I mean, and another barrier to treatment, and I try to bring this in. So there are certain points that I like to bring in to any space or platform because it's very important that we address. And I know that people talk about cost. So I'm cognizant in the fact that cost is a factor for why people don't seek mental health resources mm-hmm. here in the Bahamas. And so this is a dig towards the insurance companies. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, your body and your mind are of one. Body, mind, soul, spirit, right?
Mm-hmm.
So why are we not covering costs for mental health as we are for physical health? Why are we now separating them as two separate entities? Mm-hmm. I'm covering your physical health at 70%, 80%, 100%, but you have no mental health coverage.
Or for mental health, you get $50.
So I'm glad you raised that point, because we are currently planning a show with the president of the ICB. And I know, I know,
so, this doesn't have to be our show, but like,
no, but I do know that from initial conversations with her, she seems to be of the mindset of trying to reform insurance. I know where we connected was with Dr. Taz, who was a recent guest who was doing a conference on fertility. And so the same Dana Mullins Gray, who is the president of the ICB, spoke, and it was very much in favor of trying to start to change policies as to how insurance covers that area. So I know she's very much in the vein of thinking more, being more forward thinking about this. And so this is definitely going to be a part of that conversation that we have with her, because I know this is something that's come up, you know, I think almost every time we've spoken with you guys.
Plug it in.
And I think even when we had Thomas Smith on and he mentioned it, we had Rashida Brown Clark on and she mentioned it. So I know that this is a sore point for many of you within this area of healthcare. So we are looking to explore that as a part of our conversation with her, because it's something that needs to be addressed. It's all health. you know, we go back to that theme from a few years ago, mental health is health. And so we plan to have that conversation and put that plug in there for you guys, because I know it is something that is important to the conversation. So where can people find you? Any resources you have for our listeners today in this in regards to this particular area of conversation? How do people reach out and book an appointment, get more information? Where can they contact you guys?
So we are both at Oak Tree for our private practice. So in terms of the numbers, it's 825-4674 for the phone line, or 605-4083 for the mobile service here at the South location. I don't know if you have the
Collins. And then at the specialty clinic on Collins Avenue, the cell number is 802-9951. And the landline is 605-2030.
But you can also email us. So my email is Dr. Knowles, K-N-O-W-L-E-S. I'm sure you all know how to spell Beyonce's last name. At Oak Tree Medical Center, but it is the American Center, C-E-N-T-E-R, not the British, .com for the email address.
Mm-hmm. And I'm Dr. Johnson Deems at OakTreeMedicalCenter.com.
So I know you guys obviously mentioned you're at Oak Tree, you operate out of both the South and the Collins Avenue location, but I understand, and by understand this because I've seen it, and I've followed you guys have also started some social media channels to promote mental health things like that. I know you have the Mental Health Minute, so tell people where they can find you guys now on socials.
So yes, we are now into the social media space because for us, it is important to break the stigma of mental health and mental health disorders and the things surrounding it in our community. So it's a very near and dear thing for us. So you can find us at St. Cloud Medical or
St. Cloud Medical on Instagram and also on Facebook.
Awesome. All right. So we'll also drop the link to that in the description for the episodes. If you guys want to jump directly to their social media channels after you listen to this episode, you may feel free to do so. Follow them for all of the mental health minutes and everything else that you guys have going on there. And it's awesome to see you guys in that space. We do need more, especially locally, we need more people to be having these conversations and getting the information out there. So kudos to you for starting it up. I hope it grows exponentially and people are able to find wonderful nuggets of information there for years to come.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you both for taking time out of your busy schedule to be on another episode of Vital Voices. We are always glad to have you here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here as well.
Awesome. So as we wrap up today's episode for Mental Health Awareness Month, we're reminded that understanding the roots of mental health, both in our genes and in our earliest experiences, is key to healing and prevention. A heartfelt thank you again to Dr. Davina Knowles-Robinson and Dr. Tamika Johnson-Dames for sharing their expertise and helping us see how families, communities, and caregivers can be part of the solution. If this episode helped you see your own story or your child's in a new light, we encourage you to share it, seek support, and continue learning. Mental health matters every day, but especially in May. Thank you for tuning into Vital Voices. Until next time, stay informed, stay connected, and stay well. Did you miss a part of today's show? You can catch this episode and all Vital Voices episodes online at youtube.com/@VitalVoices242. See you next week as we sit down with another Vital Voice.
We'd like to thank today's sponsors, Oak Tree Medical Center and King Group of Companies, including Cool Runnings Ice, Color Me Agency, and Retro Games 242.